Well, this particular evening is about Middle Eastern poetry, mystical poetry, and the Middle Eastern mind. And I'm going to speak a little bit about the theory as well as the history, what I've done over the last 20 years with my translation work, and then give some examples. And so excuse the 5 minutes of theory to start with, because what I'm doing is part of something larger. And I want to put it into even a larger context than, say, a normal religious or spiritual context, which is what we're normally familiar with. Starting about the late 1960s, there developed a movement called ethnopoetics, which some of you may or may not have heard of. A large part of it was the work of a professor, a California professor of literature whose name was Jerome Rotenberg. And Rotenberg wrote or collected the first volume of this book in 1968, which is called Technicians of the Sacred. Now, up until that point, what we knew of the poetic literature, or what was called the poetry of other cultures, was often divided into, let's say, primitive and civilized. I know especially about this because my undergraduate work was in literature, both in German literature as well as in English literature. And essentially we didn't study what we would now call native poetries at all. And so the development of poetry was seen, you could say, formally as it went through certain forms, both in German literature and as well as through English literature. But what we knew then of the poetries of other lands, or what would have been the equivalent of poetry, was only in a certain type of translation. Now, to give you an example, since I was born in the U.S., born near Chicago, what we knew of Native American poetry was very much filtered through early ethnographers, ethnomusicologists, and other, you could say, scientific study, that sort of research, generally those people did not have, just to be very polite, much poetic sensibility or sensitivity. And so what was translated was, say, the bare content of a Native American ritual or ritual oration. If there was poetry attempted by it, usually what was done was that the poetry was, how would you say, to make it seem more honorable to Westerners, English speakers, it was made to seem like Victorian poetry or Edwardian poetry. It was rhymed into couplets or into stanzas, often which bore very little relationship to the native poetry from which it came. But again, the intent of those who were doing these early collections was to say, okay, these native peoples, they also have a culture, they also have beauty, they also have literature. But you could say it was a misplaced attempt to try to squeeze, you could say, that sort of art and that sort of culture into early or late 19th century, early 20th century Western forms. There's particularly a large anthology published in the U.S. in the first part of the 20th century called The Indian Book, in which much of the poetry from the many different native tribes in America all came out in rhymed couplets and songs, and was even transposed into Western keys, and they ended up sounding a bit like Christian hymns, the way that they were put across in this book. Again, the intent of those collecting the book was honorable. It was, you know, there wasn't anything else available, and so that was what it was. Well, Rotenberg and others came along and began to question this. And there was at this time in the movement of literature, if you think of the 1960s, particularly the late 1960s, what we might now call a confluence of interest in the way in which poetry did not simply carry meaning, but that certain poetic forms were the meaning. If you think of Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message, this sort of theory of language was beginning to be accepted, and it led to things like beat poetry and Gary Snyder and the early poetry of the 1970s and things like this. Well, as Rothenberg then began to collect, come on in, Ruby. We're having a little book group here. Rothenberg began to collect what he could find of translations of non-Western culture, and worked with poets, himself being a poet, to try to capture not just, you could say, the content of this type of poetry or ritual oration, often it was ritual oration, but also, you could say, the feeling, the sound of it. Earlier Western scholars had ignored, you could say, the repetitiveness of certain ritual oration. And they said, oh, well, it's just meaningless, it's just primitive. They're just repeating certain words. But what they didn't notice was that when certain words were repeated in ritual, or in ritual oration, as it's called in non-Western cultures, the words were repeated slightly differently, with an intonation that was so different that a Western ear actually couldn't hear it, or didn't hear it until it was attuned to it. So something was going on very similar to what's done, say, with mantra in the Far East, which most of us are more familiar with. As mantras are repeated, there's often a slight elaboration, either musically or in intonation, and that elaboration doesn't necessarily change the meaning unless the meaning is also tied up with sound. And in many cases, as in Sanskrit and some other non-Western languages, it is. So a slight difference of intonation will be a difference. So Rothenberg writes in the introduction to the first collection that he did, and this has gone through I don't know how many printings since, primitive means complex. That there are no primitive languages is an axiom of contemporary linguistics, where it turns its attention to the remote languages of the world. There are no half-formed languages, no underdeveloped or inferior languages. Everywhere, a development has taken place into structures of great complexity. People who have failed to achieve the wheel will not have failed to invent and develop a highly wrought grammar. Hunters and gatherers, innocent of all agriculture, will have vocabularies that distinguish the things of their world down to the finest details. The language of snow amongst the Eskimos is awesome. The aspect system of Hopi verbs can, by a flick of the tongue, make the most subtle kinds of distinction between different types of motion. And he goes on to give other sorts of examples of this. Now, when Rothenberg collected this, he included, you could say, non-Western poetry rendered in translation in forms that would almost be considered abstract, avant-garde forms where you have words scattered across the page and you have a spatial as well as a, you could say, a verbal sound relationship between the words. As much as possible, he tried to stretch the form of the printed word to show some of this. One example I'll give you, I mean, since it sets the scene for what I then later investigated, was a very short passage from the autobiography of Marpa. Now, some of you may know that Marpa was the teacher of Milarepa. Both lived in Tibet. And Marpa lived around the time when the old Bon, that is the old shamanic indigenous tradition of Tibet, was still surviving as Buddhism was coming into Tibet and taking on much of the flavor of this pre-Buddhist shamanic culture, this Bon culture, and sort of stands as a middle figure with a foot in both worlds, as you can see. And it's still, actually, if you look at Tibetan Buddhism today and look at what survives of the Bon religion, of which there is actually a fair amount, there's enormous similarity in a lot of the rituals. It's just that in the Bon tradition, it's not phrased in terms of the Buddha. So here's something that he was rendered from this autobiography of Marpa from the Tibetan. And again, it's a bit abstract. I'll just read it. I'll give you an explanation. It's called The Annunciation. A man born from a flower in space, a man riding a colt, foaled from a sterile mare. His reins are formed from the hair of a tortoise, a rabbit's horn for a dagger. He strikes down his enemies. A man without lips who is speaking, who sees without eyes, a man without ears who listens, who runs without legs. The sun and moon dance and blow trumpets. A young child touches the wheel of the law, which turns over. Secret of the body, of the world, of the heart of the gods. The inner breath is the horse of the bodhisattvas, whispered, whipped by compassion. It rears, it drives the old yak from the path of madness. So again, it's just sort of, you don't have many, you have some verbs, but mostly you just have images thrown out, almost as though Marpa was going, were going on a shamanic journey, which it seems as though from his autobiography he did. He was pretty much straightforward shamanic experiences, then framed within, you could say, a Buddhist context, which is what we have here. So this book is full of this. In its original edition, Rothenberg didn't include much from Europe, except by contrast. In the subsequent editions, he did, and he included Welsh, Celtic, Icelandic, and other cultures. Again, trying to stay fairly close to sound, meaning, to give the feeling of what an original listener would have heard. Part of my interest in this was in the interest of difference between oral and written language, and also, as Rothenberg says, that in these early poetries, in these non-Western poetries, we find very much this unity of form and content, and that what's communicated in these, this use of language, which is almost always oral, is more than what one might read on the page. It's more than content. Or there are various ways to hear the content that's given. In this particular type of poetry or use of language, there are layers of meaning. And so because things are repeated, often in a ritual sense, we might hear the same words different ways. And certain languages lend themselves to this more easily, particularly non-Western languages. Some Western languages can do it too, as we know from Western poetry. If you go back and look at certain poetry, you might tend to see relationships between words or sound relationships between words. But non-Western poetry, what used to be called, say, he says, as primitive poetry, which isn't anything but primitive, is full of this. When I began to do my work in Semitic languages, I was aware of this background of ethnopoetics, but also I was aware that, you could say, spiritual or the poetry that we find in the scriptures, in the Holy Scriptures, whether of Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, was also all originally given, I would say virtually all, let's say, or all of the things that I was interested in were all given orally first. They were not initially written down. The important stories of the Hebrew Scriptures, particularly those of Genesis, the Psalms, the visions of Isaiah and Ezekiel, visions, they're real visions, these would all have been told orally first before being written down. So they weren't composed in a literary sense.
Isaiah didn't write it down?
It seems not, probably, according to most biblical studies scholars. Jesus, of course, also gave all of his teachings orally to his listeners. And even the Quran is, according to Muslims, and seems according to good historical evidence, was spoken through Muhammad, you could say. So it was also in oral tradition for quite a long period of time before it was written down. It wasn't written down in Muhammad's lifetime. It was written down shortly after, but be that as it may, it was all remembered, it was all spoken. So with this sort of background, I became first most interested, of course, in the Aramaic language of Jesus, because I had been raised Christian in the Middle West of the U.S. But I'll put Jesus just on hold for just a wee bit. And after I'd done some work with Jesus in his Aramaic language, his native language, I looked at the greater context for out of which he came, which I came to see as a sort of native Middle Easternness, if you will, or a native Middle Eastern tradition. That is a tradition which is, you could say, underlying the classical religions which arose from the Middle East. Now, some people argued with this, but I think there was a very good case to be made, and still is, that while there's a great diversity within native Middle Eastern traditions, it's no greater than the diversity, say, within native African traditions, between the literatures that come out of the various tribes, and certainly no greater than the language diversity which was there in Native American traditions. According to, for instance, good historical accounts, within the state of within what was today the state of California alone, there was, before the European conquest, approximately 500 different Native American languages. 500 different languages. Fully blown languages, not dialects. After the conquest, after colonization, there remained, 100 years after the colonization, there remained only 50. So they had been decreased by a factor of 10. And that decrease has gone on even more today. But there is a great variety of different types of stories, of different myths within native tribes, different creation stories. They varied dramatically. Also, the way the tribes organized themselves was very different. Patrilineal, matrilineal, all this was extremely different, and one doesn't know it until you really start to study the Native American traditions more exactly. Well, of course there was this sort of diversity within the Middle East as well, but underlying this there was, due to the ecology, just as there was in Africa or in America, there were similarities. There were similarities of themes. There were similarities of images. Or even what one might call archetypes, even if they were not Jungian archetypes, certain themes that appeared again and again. And so in my second book, I looked at, without really, I have to say, honestly knowing where I was going, tried to gather together certain themes over a long period of time in the Middle East, themes like light or the womb, or thankfulness, or a sense of what we might call interiority in the Middle Eastern tradition. That is, what is the notion in the Middle East of the sense of the self? Is there a native psychology in the Middle East? If you look at everything from ancient Egyptian cosmology, psychology, to the Ugaritic Babylonian, on into Hebrew, Aramaic of Jesus, and Arabic, and all of this. And it seemed as though, it's not as though they were all saying the same thing, but there were certain questions, certain themes that came up again and again. And I just wanted to read to you a bit from this, one of the sections, which is on what I call the womb reality in the Middle East. And the reason, or the breath from the womb. This word for womb in the Semitic languages becomes very, very important, becomes extremely important. More than just an image and a story, the word rechem in Hebrew became the word not just for the womb of the mother, that which gives birth, you could say the physical womb, but it became really the origin of the most important word for divine or sacred compassion. What one receives from Elohim or from Yadhe Vavhe. Similarly, with Jesus, he repeatedly uses the word Rachme or Rachmane, which is based on the same root for womb. Every surah in the Quran, save one, also begins with two words, two of the three words in the invocation to all the surahs, save one, also use this word, Bismillah, Rahman and Rahim. Rahman and Rahim both are derived from this ancient Semitic root for womb. Again, these are clearly feminine images, but we're talking about something taking a center place, at least in sacred language, for thousands of years. Well, why? Or maybe not why, but if we put these voices alongside of each other, what might we hear? This is a brief text. Again, it was originally given in oral tradition because it was used in a liturgy by a little-known group that actually still survives today, called the Mandians. And the Mandians are a native tradition of Iran, not Christian, not Jewish, and not Islamic. Their sacred language is Aramaic, a particular dialect of Aramaic, and not much is known about them, or wasn't known about them, up until, say, about 5 or 10 years ago, when Mandians began to come and speak to Western scholars about their tradition. According to them, their main prophetic figure was John the Baptist. He was the primary figure of revelation, if you will. And so baptism, and a very elaborate ritual baptism, is their main ritual. Very elaborate. And they've allowed now Western scholars to video this baptism ceremony. And I saw it at the American Academy of Religion a few years ago, the video that was taken. And it goes on, I think, over 3 days. I mean, we're talking very elaborate baptism. Very interesting. But this is from one of their liturgical texts, one of their invocations, you could say. And again, they use a formula somewhat similar to what we find in Jesus as well as in Quran, but in a different form. That is, an invocation that begins in the name of. But see, I think this is not really, it's not limited to the Middle East, but we find it in Bismillah Rahman Rahim, we find it in Jesus' Beshameh, pray, he says to his disciples, in the name of, in with my light or with my name. So the Mandians have something like this, and again, this is rendered to try to get some of the feeling of the oral, but it's difficult. In the name and light of the most powerful life, worlds combined to form the first body, each head, each neck, each breast, each leg, each liver, each spleen, each stomach, each male and female organ, skin, hair, nails, was originally its own world. They all carry on a friendly conversation. When they don't, or one does not join in, then the whole body is in trouble. Next came the soul, a renewing, gracious self that links us to the sphere of luminous vibration. After soul took shape, the body formed the breath of its own radiant life. This vital spirit animates and connects it to all other bodies. And, after body, soul, and breath took shape, then the womb was formed, an enclosing darkness from which new life radiates. The womb is a great world. There is none greater or more powerful. The blood within the womb radiates pure purpose. The blood within the heart radiates precious refinement. The blood within the liver radiates plentiful beauty. The blood within the veins radiates pure surrender. These four radiant vibrations control the whole body. If there were only three, there would be no body. And it goes on from here. This is as much as I rendered. And so in each, you could say, each liturgy or each ritual, some form of this telling, you could say this remembering, this storytelling of the creation in the form of worlds combining would be enacted or performed. These are the Mandians. Yes, and I mention them because they do still survive. Next to this, before this, I had something from the Babylonian, and then following it, around about the same time, slightly earlier, from the Gospels in Aramaic, where Jesus speaks to Nicodemus in the Gospel of John, and he says, unless you are reborn from the first beginning, which is sometimes translated from the Greek as born again, which is a big deal in the U.S., I can tell you. But in the Aramaic, it says literally, unless you are born from the first beginning. As I rendered it, unless a human being is completely regenerated, propagated, and reborn from the center of existence, from the primal origin of light and fire, that person will not see the sudden vision, be illuminated by the flash of the I can of the cosmos, the creative fire of the soul's source. And Nicodemus in Aramaic, misunderstands Yeshua or Jesus to be saying, well, I'm supposed to go back inside my mother's, literally the Aramaic renders it as vagina, but inside the mother's womb, well, that's obviously impossible. What are you, crazy? And Jesus says, no, you're misunderstanding me. What I'm talking about is reliving creation. Go back into the darkness, relive the moment of creation as an inner experience, and then you will understand what I'm talking about.
You said 3 days for baptism.
Yes.
Is that for one person, or is that a community?
They would do, well, what we saw, what they allowed scholars in Washington, D.C. to videotape, I think in the Potomac River, actually, which I hope was a clean. But anyway, was a group of people undergoing this. And there was fasting involved by the initiates and other sorts of preparation, and then over this 3-day period, and prayer and other sorts of ritual, and then literally water, various types of full immersion baptism with things going on, is all I could say, since I'm not a scholar of it, but much was going on. And it went, I mean, these being, you know, religious studies scholars, they videoed everything. You know, it was a long thing to watch. And but anyway, it was fascinating, actually. Now, I won't tell you how I got interested in the Aramaic of Jesus, but anyway, long story short, I was interested, I was raised more or less in a non-traditional family anyway, and that my parents were mostly interested in Bible stories, chiropractic, and Rachel Carson, with Edgar Cayce on the side. So, I mean, my upbringing was non-traditional. But we were raised with Bible stories. My parents were not very, you know, theology wasn't really their thing, and not really what we would call traditional religion. But they were interested in sort of a religious upbringing for us, which I'm very grateful to. I was, however, because we lived in a small town in Illinois, my brothers and I were sent to Missouri Synod Lutheran grammar school and secondary school. And for those of you that don't know, Missouri Synod Lutheranism is not the liberal Lutheranism that one finds in Germany, for instance, which is the state church of Germany, which isn't really all that different from the Church of Scotland. But it's quite, quite conservative, very conservative. I would say in some, almost charismatic, not fundamentalistic, but charismatic, which is a little different. Although our branch wasn't that charismatic, it was a bit dull, which was a bit sad. So as exciting as we got was to memorize Luther's Small Catechism and all of the proof texts in it from the King James Bible and things like that. So it was a very good training for the memory, which is good if you're going to study language. And in addition, in my family, I did grow up hearing different languages because my parents were first-generation Americans. So their parents, who were alive, were still speaking German, Polish, Yiddish, and Russian, which we heard all sort of mixed all together. So that was predisposed me to get into these crazy things. When I began to look at Semitic languages, out of interest of Jesus, and also some interest in, initially very early interest in Arabic, of the Sufis, I found particular qualities which meant that I had to really take seriously what Rotenberg and others were saying about this whole ethno-poetic context of non-Western languages. First, because, as I say, these things were originally oral, and second, because it seemed as though Semitic languages were very different from Western languages in the whole way that they understood the world. Semitic languages are based on a root and pattern system, as I described a bit the other day. That means that meaning is produced by individual letters, which are then married, and then sometimes married again. So two letters will marry, sometimes two other letters will marry, or they'll marry like this. And the meaning of each letter, and each letter has a sort of meaning or direction or energy, contributes to the interpretation of the whole world, the whole word, and the whole world. Now, you could say, well, how would they ever get anything done? Well, you know, how would you say, well, you know, I'm just going around the corner to get a pint of milk. Well, in this case, you had to understand what level of language the person was using. And that was clearly understood. So common sense language, what we would call everyday language, descriptive language, would be understood in that context. But the words that were spoken by a storyteller, a prophet, particularly in this tradition, were considered in a different context. Also, words that came through sort of prophetic vision were considered very differently. And this is where one had developing in the Semitic languages, not just in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but even before this in Egyptian and Ugaritic, ways of hearing, ways of rendering what a prophet or what a mystic or what a shaman had said. I know it's a little bit, you can't necessarily use the word shaman for a Middle Eastern tradition because it's normally only used for Asian, but some of these prophets seem to have actually functioned like shaman, and that they went into very intense trance states, as even is described in the Hebrew Bible, and as they received a vision from the Holy One, trembling and shaking and all sorts of other almost say visionary experience would have happened. So in addition to this quality of the roots, that one could hear different levels of language, different meanings, also there was sound meaning within phrases. We know from English poetic forms that we have what's called assonance, which is where you have internal rhyming within certain lines, usually with open vowel sounds. And also we have alliteration, which is where consonantal sounds repeat. Well, Semitic languages, particularly in songs, ritual orations, visions, parables, sayings, things like Genesis 1, have much of this going on. Semitic languages are very much have a very rich aspect of this inner sort of pointing from one word to another, in a way, through the sound. And one doesn't notice this unless you're reading the original. And you certainly don't notice in translation, and I'm not really able to bring much of it out in my translations either, but it shows you something that's like a finger pointing between certain words. And the listeners would have heard this, or would have been able to reflect on it, or both. Some of it's pitch, some of it's just open sounds within certain words, usually vowels. And then alliteration, where you see the same root here in the first part of, a parabolic statement, and the other root, the reflexive part of the root, is down in the second part. One finds this in Jesus' Beatitudes quite a bit, which again are an evidence of something that was actually spoken, not written later. Really spoken by a person, not composed, would have, at least it's evidence to me.
That's similar to Samyoga in Sanskrit, where the two come together and seem to mean anything.
You know, my Sanskrit is almost non-existent, so, but it sounds like it could be. Yeah. And so, particularly in Judaism and Islam, this led to a whole way of understanding sacred language, which in the Jewish tradition is called Midrash. And Midrash is you know, you find quite a bit of modern midrash going on, reflections on passages in scripture. Well, the Hebrew in this means such and such, and it means this, and so what does that mean to us? And here's another level of it, and here's how it applies to the ecological crisis. My friend Rabbi Arthur Waskow, who was here 3 years ago, he's blogging constantly. He's got midrash coming out of it. You know, he's blogging all the time about the Hebrew scripture and the portion for the day and how it relates to the ecology and what the Bush administration is doing. And, you know, and that's just one example of sort of modern midrash. There's also midrash with a capital M, which is the classical rabbinical midrash on portions of the Hebrew scripture, and these were written, and they're not changeable, but this is volumes and volumes of midrash on the various books, midrash on Genesis, midrash on other books of the Torah, which are essentially discussions amongst the rabbis about, well, you know, when God says in Genesis 1:26, let us create the human in our image, who's the us? And then they go on for, you know, 20 pages about, well, it could have been this, and it could have been that, and you know, and that's midrash. Midrash is a bit like arguing about it. Or it's like, here's the possibilities, you decide. Islam doesn't have it quite as well developed in the whole tradition, but certain branches of Islam do have it. Islam distinguishes between what's called tafsir, which is the common sense meaning of any particular passage of the Quran, and what's called ta'wil, which is the inner meaning. And ta'wil is very similar to midrash in that it works with roots, it works with the multiple meanings, and it works with other possibilities. However, one mostly finds ta'wil in the mystical branches of Islam, either Sufism or Ismaili Shiism. There are various non-Sufi mystics, Islamic mystics. Sufis are not the only mystics in Islam, is what I mean to say more simply. But mostly they are, but not completely. We've had several people come from the Institute for Ismaili Studies in previous years here. So, you know, that was the backdrop to what I found myself engaged in. And initially, looking at Jesus' words in Aramaic, I simply took the most common sense approach, which was to start with something key, start with something central, like Jesus' prayer in Aramaic, the Lord's Prayer, and then to line up meanings, 5 or 6 or 7 deep. You say line them up horizontally, and I'll just show you a bit of, which is what I did 20 years ago. So here's the Aramaic, da-da-da. Here's the transliteration with the Aramaic. Here's the King James Version. And here are, what are they? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Well, 7 stanzas, let's say, which attempt to draw out the meaning of the 2 Aramaic words. None of these stanzas would necessarily be a complete translation because of the multiple meanings possible in the words. The one I open to is the second line of the Lord's Prayer, Hallowed be thy name, in the King James Version, or Nitka the Shemoch in Aramaic. And again, because it's hard to believe it was 20 years ago I did this, but 20 years ago I chose to use, for reasons of support, the same poetic form that William Blake uses in most of his poetic work. Because Blake, again, looking at what Rotenberg and others had done, you have to look for support where you can find it within English poetry. And Blake was of the same sort of poetry. It's coming out of an oral, very much of a symbolic oral unitive tradition. By unitive, I mean where there's the form and the content, cosmology, psychology, our place in the universe is what is being talked about, not just content, not just meaning. And so I use that particular poetic form, which is neither rhyming nor rhythmic, strictly speaking, but in which one counts the syllables of each line, and it creates a certain overall rhythmic effect. And so this was first attempts. Focus your light within us, make it useful, as the rays of a beacon show the way. Help us breathe one holy breath, feeling only you. This creates a shrine inside in wholeness. Help us let go, clear the space inside of busy forgetfulness, so the name comes to live. Your name, your sound can move us if we tune our hearts as instruments for its tone. Hear the one sound that created all others. In this way, the name is hallowed in silence. In peace, the name resides, a room of one's own, a holy of holies, open, giving light to all. We all look elsewhere for this light. It draws us out of ourselves, but the name always lives within. Focus your light within us. Make it useful. So it actually sort of, both in the individual stanzas, as well as in the addition of all the stanzas, the effect is sort of to almost like unfurl a carpet. By the time you come to the end of the carpet, you're actually a bit far away from where it began. And so then you bring it back, you roll it back up again into one line. So it goes like, sort of like that. Boom. And again, none of the stanzas except, well, maybe you could say, focus your light within us, make it useful. You could take that as a simple translation of the line. It could be said that that's a rendering. And then I did the same with the Beatitudes that are in Matthew, although those I would redo a little bit differently today because of some additional research I've done. As I proceeded from that, I became more interested in what Jesus' influences were. And this is, of course, the Hebrew prophets, and very strongly the book of Genesis and the Genesis creation story. Now, this was not a new idea that I had, but you could say also was going along with what biblical study scholars were saying at the time and are still saying, that much of Jesus' message can be interpreted in two dimensions to his listeners. One is in the dimension of the creation stories, and he's reminding his listeners very simply, look, you're in a desperate situation. Try to remember that creation, the energy that created this, all of this, is still present. It can be present here and now if you have a change of heart. That is a real change of heart. That was his first message. The second part of his message had to do with holy wisdom, or Sophia. And the Sophia part of his message had to do with, you could say, more of an egalitarian message. They say we shouldn't be eating and drinking together. Let's do that. They say only the priests in Jerusalem know what's whole, who's healthy, and what's sacred, and that you're unclean and unwhole if you're not of a particular caste, or if you're lame, or if you're blind. So you want to be healed? Well, he didn't actually say that, but people were coming to him to be healed, and he'd say, okay. And they were healed. So healing was not simply a miraculous act in those days. And in fact, I would say it was less a miraculous act than it was a political act. People, if you understand me correctly, not to say it wasn't a miracle. Of course it was a miracle. But it was more of a miracle to us, to our minds, because we have this whole background of Western scientific rationalism and, you know, oh, well, it's just, you know, now we would call it anecdotal healing. When you have, you know, instant remission of a tumor, it's like, well, we don't keep track of the statistics on that. And you could call it a miracle, but we just don't keep track of it. We don't keep track of how many miracles there are. So it's not scientifically significant. Well, people in those days didn't have that sort of mentality. Now, whether it was a magical consciousness that they lived in, or whether they really did believe that Elohim was coming again, or Chochmah was coming again, Sophia, in the form of this person, Jesus, they had more of what we would call a willing suspension of disbelief for the sort of healing that Jesus did. There was more of a, you could say, a context in which that sort of healing could actually occur for it to happen. And that seems to be very important. So as I say, it was actually more of a political act for him, for Jesus to be doing these healings than a miraculous act, although certainly it got people's attention, because the prophets did say, and the late Hebrew literature did say, that when Sophia, Holy Wisdom, comes again, there will be healings. Healings will happen, the dead will be raised, and there will be someone who will gather us all together, and there will be enough food for all, and things like this. So all of what you see Jesus enacting in the Gospels is not a performance piece, although it might be called that today. I mean, it's actually a real performance piece, but he's enacting holy wisdom, and that was the second part. But you could say his background and a lot of what his sayings talk about is really Genesis, be born from the first beginning, realize Genesis consciousness in yourself. Then you'll know the power that can make real change. So I became very intrigued with Genesis. I get really excited about this, although it bores people stiff. But anyway, and so I just, you know, I really got way too far into Genesis. And I did one rendition of Genesis 1:1 to 2 verse 3 in Desert Wisdom. And then about 10 years later, I did another one because I wasn't satisfied. And in this case, I tried doing what I call a vertical translation rather than a horizontal one, which means that here, it's hard for you to see, but since I didn't put the Hebrew in here, I just put transliteration. I lined up the Hebrew in the left-hand column, and then you sort of read across, and it would be as though a storyteller were saying this to, you know, say his, her audience, or son or daughter. Waha'aretz haita tohu wabohu, wahoshek ha'peni tahom. You know, or you might stop and you say, Waha'aretz haita. And then you elaborate on, you know, you would elaborate on it. You would improvise on it like music, which is what storytellers always do. And so I tried to do it this way, again, what you can get. And it came out something like this. Now what I'm dealing with is Genesis 1 verse 2. And I'll fill you in about what the King James is so you have an idea. Genesis 1 verse 2, and the earth was without form and void. And really this is the actual beginning of the story, because Genesis 1:1 is the what you might call the overture in a musical sense of a musical. In the beginning God created, Elohim created heaven and earth. This is like the whole picture. It's not like, well, first God did this, and then this other thing happened. No, this was like the summary of the whole thing first, and then the story begins. And this is typical of Semitic storytelling. You give sort of an overture, or in the first line is the whole story. And the earth was without form and void. Waha'aretz. Our individual existence, the sense of self and integrity that we see in every being, Haita, is at this point still existing as something living, yet latent. We can only call it by names like Tohu, a watery formlessness, spreading destruction, like a mythic sea monster, and Wabohu, an earthy emptiness, devouring life and food, like a mythic land monster. Life as we know it at this moment of creation flows between existence and non-existence, like the state we experience just before sleep and upon awakening. Yet this seeming chaos holds great power and possibility in its womb. It is the germ of the seed of life awaiting its time to sprout, or even the dream of the germ waiting in the petal of a flower as the winter wind blows it away. And so it's all midrash. Except at this point, where it stays closer to the, you sort of attempt it, translation of the roots, and then it extrapolates out into storytelling or poetry. I'll read you a little bit more, so you know how the story ends up, because this is just sort of the beginning, the overture. Genesis 1:2, The second part, am I skipping some part? Oh, yes, sorry. And it continues, Wahoshek, Wahoshek, al peni tahom. Now, what I'm intoning actually is, you don't want to know this. Well, I'll tell you anyway, is the best guess of what biblical Hebrew would have been pronounced like when it was originally spoken, not what's spoken in the synagogue. If you want to get into that later, I'll talk about it. So he says, without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Wachoshech, the great darkness is already right here. Everything we can't know or control, everything too compressed to expand, too closed to be open, too mysterious to penetrate with any understanding. Just like heat and cold battling for control, one trying to expand, the other to contract. Alpene, like the play of emotions flashing across our faces at a time of surprise or shock, it is existing to home on the surface of a larger tohu, a deeper chaos that is inside the seed of the seed of the seed of existence. There is so much space, so much flow there, that the great dark itself only dances on its waves. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Waruach Elohim marachefet al penei hamayim. Waruach Elohim. And then the breath of the Holy One, of the same substance as our breath, marachefet, begins to move in and out, back and forth and over. It flutters and moves, turning near and into Alpene, the surface of the Hamayim, primordial flow, the essence of the water we know today. One could say that the being of beings blows a kiss toward beloved possibility, who felt the breath on her face. She pauses, is reminded of something she thought she knew, or had been, or wanted to do. But this is a deja vu from the future, and she falls into the arms of the One in the eternal now. And after all this rather intense coming and going, you have the let there be light, and there was light. So you could say, in this very, very extremely compressed Hebrew, in some ways a different sort of, a qualitative way, a different sort of Hebrew than one finds even in the later part of the Hebrew scriptures, extremely dense, you have a story that's unfolding, almost like a gloss on a story that then a storyteller would improvise upon each time it was told anew. A shorthand, if you will, that has so much built into it. And in this particular rendition, it's as though you have this chaotic darkness, and the breath makes love with the divine breath makes love with darkness, and there the birth of this making love is consciousness or light. Let there be light, and there was light. And so this very early part of the creation story is described in actually a very similar way to what we might describe as the process of psychological insight. We breathe into the darkness, what we don't know within ourselves, and from that insight, consciousness, awareness of something arises. So perhaps it wasn't simply a creation story, that is a non-scientific myth in Western parlance, but perhaps it was also a reminder of what's important psychologically, or what's important in terms of our origins, our relations with others. As I proceeded further on, and this happens, of course, people ask questions, which is good, and people request various translations, or particular puzzles come up. Prayers of the Cosmos, as I say, considered the Lord's Prayer and Matthew's Beatitudes, which are very key to Jesus' teaching, but it's not the only part of his teaching. And that book raised so many more questions that I took a different approach in my third book, Hidden Gospel, which is less of a collection of poetic, how would we say, renditions, and more an attempt to categorize Jesus' key words in each of about 10 chapters. So if you only could know 10 words in Aramaic to understand Jesus' teaching better, what would those 10 words be? That was the question I posed for myself. And then I could say, okay, I've given you those 10 words, and I've given you all the roots in the back, rendered backwards from the word that's in the King James Bible. I give you for each of Jesus' major sayings what the Aramaic word being used is and the possible meanings of the root. So it's a weird sort of reverse. We're repeated in rich would allow the reader, not knowing Aramaic, to do their own midrash. And that was my original intent, you see. Otherwise, it's too difficult. Now, I don't know how I came up with this. It was in a moment. It was on some retreat or something. And most people still don't use the book this way, but you can use it that way. In other words, you can look up any particular passage in the King James, and any of the key words that Jesus uses, you can look the English in the King James up, and it'll give you the Aramaic root that's used in the Peshitta, that's used in the Aramaic version of the scriptures. So you can actually do it. And you know, this sort of followed on from certain things, and I did do some poetic renditions, but I tried to be more simple. So I attempted as best as possible to get it in one, if you will. And then I gave the explanation of what's going on sort of in prose in the chapter. So again, I'll read you a little bit from the chapter on breath. And Rucha, breath, is one of the top ten for Jesus. To know that the word he uses for spirit is also breath, that's one of the top ten to know. John 4:24, for instance, says very simply that Jesus says to an audience, God is a spirit. God is a spirit. And that's a very curious statement, which he doesn't really elaborate upon. But it does tie into some of his other sayings about spirit and about breath. Now, God is a spirit in Aramaic is rendered very simply as Allaha Ruchau. It's two words. Aramaic doesn't have a verb, doesn't have an is, doesn't have a being verb. So if you want to, wherever you see is, basically they're just putting two words together. Aramaic isn't unique in this, but it is a feature. So the is always interpolated. It's always added in by the translator, including me. And a short rendition of this is possible meanings. God is breath. Allah is breath. All that breathes resides in the only being. From my breath to the air we share, to the wind that blows around the planet, sacred unity inspires all. So in the end bit, sort of launches into a bit of poetry, but the rest is just simple translation. Just different ways of reading those words, Allah Ruhau. You can read them front way, you can read them back way, backwards, and that's within the tolerance of possibility for Semitic languages. Or the Beatitude, where Jesus uses this word, the Matthew form of this Beatitude, which is the first of the Beatitudes, both in Matthew and Luke, which the King James translates, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. From the Aramaic, might be heard like this. Ripe are those who reside in breath. To them belongs the reign of unity. Blessed are those who realize that breath is their first and last possession. Theirs is the I can of the cosmos. The rest of the chapter then talks about this, talks about the root, talks about the way this might have been considered, and looks at, I would say, the other major examples where Jesus uses the word spirit as it's reported in the four canonical Gospels. In this particular book, I didn't get really much want to go much into the Gospel of Thomas, because I wanted to stay with where most of the questions I was receiving were coming from, and those were based on the four canonical Gospels. There was, of course, there were many questions that came up about the unforgivable sin, if you recall this. The unforgivable sin is based on Matthew 31, so-called unforgivable sin, where Jesus says, as it's translated in the King James Version, "Wherefore I say unto you, all manner of sin and blasphemy shall be forgiven unto men, but the blasphemy against the Holy Ghost shall not be forgiven unto men." Well, I mean, if one's raised Christian, there's all sorts of manner of theological speculation about what the sin against the Holy Ghost might be. And since it is unforgivable, you certainly don't want to do it, whatever it might be. And as a child being hearing some of this in school, you think, oh my God, you know, what if I do the unforgivable sin? It's like, you know, that's it. Well, I was pleased to find out that it wasn't quite that. It's not even really that in the Greek. Knowing a little bit more about the Greek now, it could have been rendered better, even from the Greek. Because the sin, as some people, the word for sin in Greek means to miss the mark. It's an archery term. In Aramaic, it's similar, although it's not an archery term. It simply means a failure or a mistake. It has some other meanings in terms of the roots.
Is this the word for blasphemy?
No, this is the word for sin. The word for blasphemy in Aramaic means to cut oneself off from something or to interrupt a connection, a relationship that is there. One of the ways, the way I put it in this book is, here are some of the nuances that Jesus' listeners might have heard. Because we're hearing it with Aramaic ears. I'm not saying this is a total translation, but here are some of the other nuances they might have heard from this particular passage. And I won't read you the Aramaic. "All types of tangled behavior, the missing and the failing, the rips and tears, all the ways you cut yourself off, break your connection, or disrupt the pattern, can and will be mended. Sooner or later, you will be freed from error, your mistakes embraced with emptiness, and your arrhythmic action return to the original beat. But your state cannot be mended or repaired when you cut yourself off from the source of all rhythm, the inhaling, the exhaling, of all air, wind, and atmosphere, seen and unseen, the holy breath." It's, in this sense, a Semitic way of saying when we cut ourselves off from community, from the breath that connects us all, that cannot be mended until we begin to breathe again and to feel, oh, I'm not, in John Donne's words, an island. It's not, the universe is not for me, so to speak. It's not all about me, as we say. You know, yes.
If you accept that, for example, from the Greek, that, you know, there are these unreasonable translations, the question remains is, what was the source of inspiration for them?
For the Greek translation?
For the error of translation.
There are choices to be made in the Greek as well. And again, one of my friends has done quite a bit of scholarly work on this, particularly on this word for breath, in that Greek has several words for breath. And Jesus almost always uses this word, which we, and my Greek pronunciation is terrible, pneuma, which is the basis of our word pneumatic, pneuma, and that if the translators from the Greek into the English had, how would we say, more of a mystical and less of a theological orientation, they could have rendered it differently. Even using King James English, it could have been done differently. But, again, you know, it was kept within, how would we say, a certain parameter, because at the time that the King James was done, we're already well into the development of Western Christianity by that time. And so the range of meaning that could be seen even by the translators was more limited by that time. Now, of course, we could go back to the Greek, and some people have thought to do that, say, well, there might be more there too. Could be more there. For me, you know, what was convincing, I couldn't do everything. Convincing was to me that Jesus spoke it orally in Aramaic. At least everything that I was interested in, he must have said in Aramaic. He wouldn't have used Greek because his listeners wouldn't have understood him. Someone asked me recently, well, how did Jesus speak to Pontius Pilate? And I said, well, he might have known a few words of Greek, because actually, if you look at the accounts of Jesus and Pilate, Jesus doesn't say a heck of a lot. I mean, he might have had a nice opportunity there to, you know, throw in a few zingers or, you know, and mostly he just says, well, you say I am, and, well, it's not much there. So maybe it was in Greek, and he just, you know, or who knows who was reporting, who was taking it down. It's, you know, again, these things would have been oral tradition. And, you know, who, if you think about it, if it was all an oral tradition, who reported what was said by Pilate or what was by Jesus in any case? Pilate? Maybe, I don't know. It's interesting. Well, anyway, we're moving along here, and I'm almost at the done of, not quite finished. My most recent rendering from Aramaic was done in this book, and here I undertook, I would say, a little bit, well, I went back to sort of the storytelling form, if you will, particularly for Jesus' final talk with his disciples in the Gospel of John, the so-called farewell talk. In addition, in the book I did a couple of years ago, I did Luke's Beatitudes, which are different than Matthew's Beatitudes. And they have their own beauty, although a fair amount of it is similar to Matthew, but then a fair amount isn't similar to Matthew, because he has, well, not really what you say are blessings and cursings, but he has, you could say, statements which are, this is a ripe state of being, and if this has happened to you, warning to you. It's not really the same sort of cursing, curseds are, that one finds in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that the Qumran community was doing ritual cursing of their enemies, as well as ritual blessing of their friends. Jesus, it's not that. Jesus is using a different form. But he is saying, if this is happening to you, watch out. Watch out for certain things. So for the word for blessing, he uses the word tubekun, ripe are you. This is a ripe state. You may not think it's a ripe state, but let me reframe it for you, and this can be seen as a ripe state. And if you're experiencing this, well, be careful, watch out. Warning to you. Here's some flags. Some historical Jesus scholars have translated these more literally as blessings and cursings, but I argue with some of the so-called of those folks, the Jesus Study Circle and those other folks, because when they use terms like damn you and things like this, there was no place to damn people to at the time, because Jesus didn't have a later theological conception of hell. There was no place to damn people to. You could say you could do like the Qumran people do and say, well, cursed are those. But it wasn't like damn them to hell, because there wasn't a damning to hell. There was no conception of hell as eternal punishment at that stage. That was a later conception. The King James has this: blessed are ye when men shall hate you, and when they shall separate you from their company, and shall reproach you, and shall cast out your name as evil for the Son of Man's sake. Tubwechun ma damchasnein lachon, neinasha wa merapeshan lachon, wa marahastein lachon, sorry, wa mafakkein shemchon aik bisha hilaf bar denasha. You may not think so, but it can be blessedly ripe. and just the right thing to discover your true purpose when people see you in a bad light, coloring your true colors with their own inner hue and cry. When people single you out for abuse because of the wounds they have felt inside, when you are conspired against and things get said behind your back, when your good name gets tossed about, shut out, and carried here and there as if it were a waste of time to mention you. All this happens because people see in you someone who is trying to fulfill the divine image, who lives according to their real purpose. Yet, in the distorted funhouse mirror of a heart they currently carry within, they see you backwards, which is the way they see themselves. And then he goes on to mention certain things that one should watch out for, warnings, which are something like this is one of them. Woe unto you when all men shall speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets. Wailachon kadnawan amarein alechon b'nei adashafira hakanager abdein hawa lenabia dagaluta abhatahon. Too bad, unfortunate. Woe and warning. Cut off from the divine time are you, when people say light, bright, and beautiful things about you, when they look only at the outside of the glass and reflect back its surface, when there is no one who has the first inkling of how to say a true word around you. This is the same state experienced by those who lied to themselves all the way through, who mistook their own inner dishonesty for the divine voice trying to be heard within, and led others to do likewise, who were heaping up outer reflections and projections like a veneer over the soul, until the mirror of the heart no longer revealed their true self. So, in this one, I essentially return to some of the forms, although a little bit more expanded, that I started with 20 years ago in Prayers of the Cosmos, books actually the same size in a similar format, two big bits with some other miscellaneous sayings in between. Lately, what I've got into, as some of you know, is the way in which the Quran works the same way, and in particular, the key words of the Quran, which are grouped into what the Sufis call the Asma al-Husna, the beautiful names of Allah. All of these so-called 99 beautiful names are found in the Quran, and these are used in a mantric or in a spiritual practice sense by the Sufis. And each of these individual words, names, attributes, pathways of the heart, as I call them in Sufi Book of Life, also can be rendered several different ways. In both a traditional way as well as in a more, what I would say, personal experiential way, from the inside out. What's the experience that's being talked about here in the Quran?
When you say red, is that what is more discerned, hearing it or not? Discerned of the names, is that the spiritual difference?
The sound of them, yes. Also, again, composed from the roots, and the different ways in which one can intone them to bring out different feelings. Now, that one can't communicate in a book. That one can only do, say, directly. The different ways in which Ar-Rahman or Ar-Rahim, Al-Malik, Al-Qudus, these different names can be, you can emphasize certain of the root, certain parts of the root, certain sounds to bring out, you could say, the flavor, to bring out different qualities within oneself. So it's almost as though the names, well, they're used in so many different ways. They're used in an oracular sense, like one would throw the I Ching for a certain situation. One might draw, some, say, from a bowl, one of the names that would reflect back to me my particular state or the situation I'm looking at. Well, here's something to look at. Or the way in which they might be given by a spiritual teacher, and so then intoned. And usually, of course, when you receive a name or a sacred phrase from a spiritual teacher, you do it the way he or she gives it to you, because they're giving it that way for a particular reason. Often one that they don't put into words, often for very good reasons, that they don't put it into words, why they're giving it to you this way. Is it spoken? Is it sung? Is it chanted? Do you do it with your eyes open? Do you do it lying down, sitting, walking? All these are different possibilities of the way these names can be given. And because I was dissatisfied with only the traditional, which are very limited translation of the names, I would say they're very theological translations of the names, I undertook to do more of what I would call a process-oriented translation, which is what the teacher of my teacher was interested in, Samuel Lewis. Another influence on this work is a movement called General Semantics, which I hesitate to get into, but you can look it up if you are interested in it, because, you know, General Semantics basically means that when you use a word, you should know what the actual concrete referent of that word is in actual life. What are we really talking about? And general semantics is very useful as a lens in looking at, say, the language of politicians. Well, when we talk about democracy in a particular country, whose democracy? Democracy for whom? What does this democracy mean? Or is democracy actually a code word for capitalist exploitation or whatever? I mean, literally, what democracy are we talking about? Are we just throwing around words to get an emotional reaction? And so a general semantics approach, which the teacher of my teacher, that is Samuel Lewis, was very interested in, was, let's look very carefully what this is about. And he was very critical even of, you could say, traditional religious words, religious labels. He would say, for instance, I don't call myself a Muslim, I call myself an Inshallahist. He said a Muslim originally meant a person who was surrendered to the one reality, that we share one reality, as the Quran says, Surah 30:30. There's one reality, we all share it. But he says the term Muslim has sometimes come to mean, you know, a partisan of this or that, or, you know, it's some organization. He says that's not, you know, I believe in the original meaning of the word, so I'd rather call myself an Inshallahist. Inshallah means if Allah wills, which is the experience of being a Muslim, that you're always saying Inshallah. Well, if it's, you know, I'm surrendered, you know, whatever the one reality holds for me, I'm surrendered. So then he would translate, you know, certain phrases like Allahu Akbar, which literally means God is greater, the classical definition is Allah is greater. He would translate that as peace is power, because peace is power is the experience of realizing Allahu Akbar. That means the one reality is always greater than whatever immediate situation is I'm facing. Okay, it's terrible. It's really bad. Allahu Akbar. But I'm remembering that there's a greater reality. And so the experience of that is peace is power. So he's translating the experience of the word. He gets a little far away from the actual root meaning of it, but he's translating the experience of it. So that's what I tried to do in Sufi Book of Life. And I made a few mistakes I'd have to correct, but there's very few, I think I've found very few mistakes in it so far. And it's a few cases because I was comparing the root meanings across Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic, and looking at how the word was used for a couple of thousand years and the influences on the Arabic. But I think that triangulation approach was very helpful in drawing out the root meanings. And I give all the so-called normal traditional meanings that one finds in, you know, in the normal translations as well. They reflect a certain worldview, not the same culture. But they reflect a identifiably similar worldview. That's something that's bigger than culture, because the worldview is expressed through sort of language. The Semitic languages have a similar way of looking at things, even when individual cultures that use them had different approaches, and there's variety and there's diversity within that. And there's a sort of underlying unity there, which is very helpful to see.
It's helpful in reading. Different idea, the word becomes a thing, and really a word is just a pointer.
Yes. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
It is.
Yeah.
It's just
the finger pointing to the moon, as the Zen saying goes. My own teacher used to like to quote that image of the finger pointing to the moon. Yeah, and you know, particularly in these very charged areas, we're talking about translation from Hebrew scripture, the Gospels, and I have to say Quran as well. It's a very charged issue about. Literally, you would say. You could say that Quran cannot be translated. However, it is being translated. And so, even though the Quran has what's called an ijaz, that is its own uniqueness in the Arabic, translations are happening, and there are better, and from my standpoint, better and worse translations. You know, some of the more universal passages of the Quran are translated out of certain translations. And so, let's have them back again. And so while not really calling them translations, I've done some of that in Sufi Book of Life and Intent of Abraham and in my later books, the more recent books. So, so that sort of brings things up to date, and that's pretty much my whole presentation. And so I'm happy to take any other questions or comments or about anything really that anyone might have. Yeah.
Does that come from the differences between Luke and Matthew, or doing more research on both of them?
Doing more research on both of them. For instance, what I did in the Sounds True series, Healing Breath, is that's more up to date because I did that in 2002, whereas Prayers of the Cosmos was written in whenever that was, 1988. So that's but that I haven't revised Prayers of the Cosmos because the publisher was not keen on that. They don't want to put more energy into it, even though the book is still selling. But when I finally do get the rights back to Prayers of the Cosmos, then I will do some revision of that, and maybe at some point I can convince them to do a 25th anniversary edition or something. But so far they're not really that keen on it.
That's interesting. Any translation or anyone reflecting on anything, the state of the being is changing all the time.
It is.
With more study, I mean, it's almost inevitable, isn't it?
It is.
It's right, and that's really useful rather than stuck. This is how it is.
Well, that's right. That's right, and particularly because, I tried to say, you know, these are not definitive translations. This is like to open a door into something and, hey, go in, and, you know, this is as far as I've gotten, and you want to do something better? Do it. So, and some people have, so, I mean, I'm happy with that. That's fine. There are certainly many more people now working in this particular area, both in a traditional and a non-traditional sense, within the broad field of Christianity, as well as in the sort of outside of it. If you Google Aramaic, or even Aramaic Jesus, you're going to come up with many more sites than just mine these days, whereas, you know, 20 years ago, there was virtually no one doing it except for myself and, let's say, Dr. Rocco Errico, who was a student of George Lamsa. So now there are many more folks doing it. And I would say the good news is that the good news is that at least in the United States, some things have gotten into more mainstream religion, particularly in the Methodist, United Methodist tradition, included parts of Prayers of the Cosmos in their Handbook for Ministers. Of course, the Unitarians were always more or less friendly to it, more friendly in the U.S. than they are here necessarily, where it's a more secularized tradition. Unity, Church of Religious Science, Science of Mind, the so-called New Thought churches, which are virtually unknown in the UK, unfortunately, is a huge following of this particular work there. And so those communities have received this work very well.
Is there anyone who doesn't
Oh, yeah, lots of people. I was banned on certain fundamentalist websites, and I'm on the no-fly list in the Roman Catholic German website. Not overall, but the German bishops banned me, but they also banned my friend Walter Lechler, who started the 12-step groups in Germany, and they banned psychotherapy and a whole bunch of other good things. So, you know, I'm in good company there. It's not that...
It's good.
I agree. I agree. I still get, you know, actually a fairly small amount of hate mail, so it's not really that much anymore. Lately, I got, you know, things said, again, I mentioned it the other day at Column Soul Center, someone wrote and says, why don't you're mentioning all the Assyrians and all these people on your website, why don't you mention the Aramaeans and the Syrian Orthodox more? And he says, oh my God, not that again. So I went back in and I edited the website to say, well, okay, Aramaic speakers are not only the Assyrians. I had said they were Syrian Orthodox, but I put in, because they really get upset about this, that the two major branches, the one group that wants the homeland back and the other group that doesn't want the homeland back. And they really don't get along. It's too bad.
Is Aramaic still a living language?
It is still living.
Who speaks it?
Who speaks it? Well, a small group of people who live in northern Iraq speak it. Mm-hmm. In the area of the city of Mosul, the town of Mosul, which is ancient Nineveh. Mm. And they're trying to keep it alive there. Under extreme pressure, both from the Kurds as well as some Muslims, there's a sort of an Aramaic. I have a video, actually a DVD that was made there, as late as 2005, showing Aramaic school teachers teaching children Aramaic.
Are these Muslims or
It's Christians.
Christians.
These are Christians, very definitely Christians. So there's there also in eastern Turkey. Which is a different group, and they tend to call themselves Aramaeans rather than Assyrians. And they're more like, okay, we don't want to bother the Turks. We just want to live and let live. And they would say they don't care about the homeland. They just want the church will be their homeland. The Syrian Orthodox Church is big enough to be their homeland. So they're keeping things alive. I mean, the Aramaic speakers have good reason to be nervous because they were part of the Armenian genocide, but they're simply not mentioned. As many as 500,000 Aramaic-speaking peoples were killed around the same time as the Armenian genocide, but they're generally not heard about. They didn't get the same press as the Armenians. There weren't as many of them, but 500,000 is still a genocide, let's face it. So after that ended, then many of them moved to, say, Germany, Sweden, France, the United States. These are countries where we know that large groups of Aramaic-speaking Christians moved. In Sweden, in a certain area, they're allowed bilingual education by the Swedes because they reached a certain percentage of the population in a particular area. So the children get bilingual education, Swedish, and Aramaic.
So when you do your translations, which language do you...
I'm reading Syriac, which is Western Aramaic from about 300 years after the time of Jesus. That's what the Peshitta, the Aramaic Gospels, are written in. Now, as I described in Hidden Gospel, it's basically the same Aramaic as Jesus, even if it wouldn't have been pronounced the same way. The words are the same. The words are 99% the same. It's quite close in time. Mostly. Well, no, Coptic is an offshoot of the ancient Egyptian language. Now, some on that question, some biblical studies scholars now believe that some texts which we only have in Coptic, for instance, the Gospel of Thomas, or a little bit of the Gospel of Thomas is in Greek, but the most complete form of Gospel of Thomas is in Coptic. But there's some good evidence that the original form of it was Aramaic, but we don't have a copy, or we don't have a copy yet, because everything that could be found hasn't necessarily been found. But then the same opinion is then also in terms of the Gospel of John, that many biblical studies scholars now believe that the first form of the Gospel of John was also in Aramaic. Now that's new. That's new in the last 10 years, because John was always, up till then, considered much later than Matthew and Mark. Well, now it seems that opinion, that which was the majority opinion in biblical studies scholarship, has been overturned, and that John may have been also a very early gospel, just in a very different form than Matthew and Luke, and using different sources, or some sources similar and some quite different. So the, you could say the awareness of Aramaic and the Aramaic of Jesus has come up much more. You know, and say a little bit due to Mel Gibson as well and his Passion of the Christ and things like that, although, you know, the theology in it is terrible, medieval. Nothing to do with Jesus, but anyway, I mean, in the part about the sort of the blaming the Jews and all that, this is terrible. It's completely inaccurate, but anyway. But it did raise the profile of Aramaic.
Yeah.
Late Aramaic. Well, because by that time, and Daniel was one of the latest of the, how would we say, the Hebrew scripture books composed, you know, maybe only 2 or 3 centuries before Jesus. By that time, after the group had come back from captivity under Ezra, they were all speaking Aramaic. And so the language of composition then ceases to be this ancient Hebrew and it starts to be Aramaic. Thank you very much for your attention with my presentation.